Okay, welcome to Technocratic Tyranny Blues. Let me turn the gain up on here just a little bit so I can hear myself. It's better. It's midnight. We're moving from the 14th of October to the 15th of October at midnight in 3 minutes' time. And I've got a piece to play that's on BitChute. I think it's just gone onto BitChute. There's 26 people watched it up to now. It's about an hour, and it's Colonel Tom Bearden speaking about Soviet weather modification over North America in 1985. I don't know where this comes from originally, but I'm going to play it, and I'm going to listen to it. I may use some clips on a show that I'm putting together on weather modification and harp. If it turns out to be good stuff, and it looks like it's probably good stuff, so let's just have a listen.
Subject for this evening is Soviet weather engineering over North America, which they have been doing since the beginning of 1966-1967. That was the first shot, our attempt at influencing the weather directly over the United States. They then lapsed into a lot of not influencing it for a period of years, and in 1983, particularly, really opened up the big guns after having energized the infamous Woodpecker signals, the so-called Horizon radars, in the communications band in the mid-1970s. The first thing I'm going to have to tell you is that there are three kinds of electromagnetics, and only one is being used today in the Western world. The first kind is the kind we all study as electrical engineers, and even us nuclear engineers study a little bit of it. And it's classical electromagnetics. The foundations of that go back before the Civil War. It's quite old, and there are serious flaws and many errors in it, as is quite well known in a few circles. The second kind, first of all, let me characterize the first kind of electromagnetics. Everything is due to the force fields, the so-called electric field, magnetic field. If that reduces to zero in an area, you don't have any more electromagnetics going on in there. The potentials themselves are considered to be mathematical figments. Now, I'm going to be giving you a little background, I'm going real fast through it, but you'll need this to understand what I'm talking about in weather engineering and understand it. So please bear with me during the first part. We're going to have a little quick slating. The second kind of electromagnetics came from quantum mechanics, and it's exactly opposed. The primary and real things are the potentials, and the force fields, so-called, are totally derived by differentiating operations. So you see a flip-flop of 180 degrees about how the two approaches regard electromagnetics. Further, in quantum mechanics, when the electric field and the magnetic field reduce to zero in an area, you still may have the potentials. And if these potentials, which are the real things going on, interfere with each other, you can have real effects still produced in charged particle systems, real physical systems. As a matter of fact, in 1959, a classic paper by Aronoff and Baum in Physical Review pointed this out very strongly, and since then, part of that has come to be called the Baum-Aronoff effect, or sometimes the Aronoff-Baum effect. It had been in physics 30 years at that point, pointed out by Richard Feynman, the Nobel Prize winner, and ignored. It has continued to be ignored in the nearly 30 years since 1959, when it was strongly pointed out by Baum and Aronoff. What we are saying, ladies and gentlemen, is if we can make this effect exist in the big world, they think it exists only in the micro world, we can get action at a distance, that's no longer a dirty word, and we can get action even when there is no ordinary electromagnetics going on. And I'm going to show you how to do that. And in the process, I'm going to show you how to change the mass and inertia of an object, affect its rate of flow through time, affect the gravitational field, and so forth. Now, the third kind of electromagnetics is the mechanism by means of which you do those things. In other words, you reduce the ordinary electromagnetics to zero. The electric field and magnetic field, deliberately. You do this by making a zero system. You oppose the vectors so that they sum to zero, but they are still there in the substructure. Hey, when we studied electromagnetics, they forgot to tell us that a zero vector was not nothing. It can be a system of very active forces, each of which is time-varying, and yet the system will not be detectable by any ordinary instrument. It turned out that the unorthodox scientific community in the United States has been using this for some years, but not expressing it quite that succinctly. For example, the Hooker patents. What we are saying now is that if we do this, if we make deliberate zeros, but we make them with vectors which are still there and active, we have a new kind of electromagnetics, a third kind. And I have dubbed that scalar electromagnetics, and I hope the reason for the name will become clear a little later. I won't bother to read that thing. We simply have a zero vector envelope. But it's the substructure that we have placed within a zero that is fantastic. In terms of modern physics, we have reached into the virtual world, what happens before physical change occurs, and we now can deliberately engineer it. Let me say that again, in case it went by you. With this simple mechanism, with few coils and transistors and so forth, by making deliberate zeros, we can deliberately engineer the Schrodinger equation, and we can deliberately affect the probabilities of quantum mechanics. The hidden variable theory now becomes directly engineerable in all the implications of what I have said. What had been statistical before now becomes at least partly deterministic. I'm going to jump now a whole bunch of years. In 1921, at the instigation or recommendation of Albert Einstein, a man by the name of Kaluza published a paper where he had successfully united electrical field and gravitational field in a common unified theory. To do that, he had to add another physical dimension, and a very strange thing emerged. There's really only one field in nature if you're looking at that hyperspace. It is the five-dimensional gravitational field, and it intersects our world in two things. One thing we call the electromagnetic field, and the other thing we call the gravitational field in the general sense, general relativity, the ability to curve and warp and twist space-time itself. And by the way, the electromagnetics just turned out to be the fifth-dimensional aspect of that. So we added one more space dimension, which we do not see. Klein, a few years later, explained what happened to that dimension. It's really rolled up around every little point in our space. Quite nice mathematically. And it's real, by the way. But the theory languished for many years until really about the early to mid-70s, when the new symmetries in the forefront of physics and particle physics began to see that with that type of geometry, you could get in all these weird particles and you could get in all the forces. You really could begin to approach a unified theory of all forces of nature. And the physicists became very excited. The modern theory, a variant of that theory, Kaluza-Klein geometry, has 11 dimensions, 10 space, 1 time. All but the three ordinary space dimensions we see are considered to be rolled up in little circles around every point. But with that thing and supergravity, you can get in all of the particles and everything we know in physics in a single unified theory. And the physicists are excited. That's the hottest thing in physics. They just haven't discovered yet that it is directly engineerable in the simplest fashion you ever dreamed of. I'm going to give you a very simple thing now to let you understand what I'm talking about. This is schematic, so don't think of the thing as being spatially separated between the two little circles on the plane. The plane represents our ordinary world, the hand represents an extra dimension. So it's that fifth dimensional geometry that Calusa came up with in 1921. The hand itself represents that fifth dimensional gravitational field, which intersects our world in two fashions, one electromagnetic shown by the forefinger extended, that intersection, and the other by the thumb, which is our gravitational field, as we see it in the little intersections. And in both of the intersections, by the way, at the same point. They are not spatially separated. Normally, we don't make vector zeros. Nobody ever trained us to do that in electromagnetics. There is not a single textbook, either physics or electromagnetics, in the United States of America or in the Western world that dwells upon what you do when you deliberately make such vector zeros. I'm almost willing to state that probably not a single orthodox physicist has made such an experiment. If they are, it will be only one or two of them. But notice what we do if we deliberately zero the electromagnetic intersection, which is what we're doing when we make the zero. But we control what goes into the zero. We can put energy in there, or we can take the energy out. When we do that, it's coming in and out of the thumb as gravitational energy, directly as curvature of space-time. Now, what have we said? We have said that rigorously, with that simple mechanism, I can provide the direct conversion of electromagnetic energy into gravitational field energy, or vice versa. Now, if you want to do anti-gravity, gentlemen, there it is. And the unorthodox researchers have been doing anti-gravity a little bit in this country for a period of years, like levitating 65 pounds, like plywood, which is not magnetic field. So with a very simple thing and looking at it through modern eyes and adding that single thing, we can now use electromagnetics to make gravitational field energy in the general sense or vice versa. We can warp, engineer, and twist space-time at will, as we wish, in whatever pattern we wish. And it's been in the literature, if you cared to notice, since 1921. I won't dwell on this. I will simply state that all of the mass is anyway, a particle of mass, is in fact a trapped scalar resonance. I'm going to give you a quick once-over about scalar resonance and we'll go on. Take a normal resonance system with a wave moving back and forth in the cavity so that it's in phase coherent. Suppose that there were two waves moving along together, but the second wave, the electric and magnetic field, were 180 out from the first one. That's a scalar resonance system. Your normal instrument won't even see it. We can build special detectors and have that will see it. That's all mass is, but you can make a current of that kind of resonance, and you can pipe that current down the wire, or you can add to that resonance in the system, or you can take it away. What did I say? I said you can pump the mass and inertia directly into an object and increase it, or you can pump it out of there. If you pump all of it out of there, it'll dematerialize on you. And the statements I am making are based in part on experimental evidence in the laboratory, private, proprietary laboratories. Now, the scalar wave, that is the wave that has a zero resultant for the electric field and a zero resultant for the magnetic field, but is composed of components which are waving and moving and communicating and everything else, is the universal wave in the universe, totally undiscovered as yet in Western science. You can make it for 10 cents on the laboratory bench. You can convert a radar very simply to be a scalar radar, for example. These waves come from and go to the nucleus. They go right through the Faraday cage. They do not interact with the electrons unless you have the most extreme nonlinear situation you've ever heard of. They don't move electrons. And you can go right through any Faraday cage. You can go right through the Earth, for example. You can go through the ocean with megahertz signals using these techniques. As we sit here talking, the Soviet Union is communicating worldwide as a 10 days ago that were communicating on well over 37 frequencies in their command and control systems for the large weapon systems they built for strategic weapons in this fashion. I have a personal friend that can deliver on the shelf the communication system, prototype already built and tested, that will prove that statement. And I challenge anybody in the United States outside of them at the present time to measure that communication system. These are nuclear waves. They communicate between nuclei. And if you put in that substructure the correct pattern, you can go in and transmute elements. In modern physics, to make a proton a neutron or vice versa, all you've got to do is flip one quark. And that is simply a pattern in the substructure. A man was nominated for the Nobel Prize in 1977 for proving that biological systems transmute elements, even though they only have millivolts and microvolts to use. And I bet you didn't even know that. His name was Kurt Arnold. Today he's dead. All the nuclei of the universe are in constant communication. Much of vacuum space-time is made up of these scale waves between the nuclei throughout the universe. Another thing that came out of the general relativistic wave, these are general relativistic waves. Special relativity does not apply. We are always in a curved space-time when we're using them. Part of the thing that came out of the theory is you are no longer confined to the speed of light at all. You're clever, you can get almost any velocity you want to, whether it's slower than the speed of light or faster. A Tesla, for example, who was using these kinds of waves shortly after 1900 and keeping it a dark secret, Tesla reported his speeds of 50 times the speed of light. I have personally participated in an experiment which kicked out an electromagnetic wave of this type at 8 times the speed of light. If you'll check the Russian literature, and I'll give you the references if you're interested, the speed of light is variable anyway. It's been known for 80 years by the astronomers that the speed of light in the hard vacuum on the surface of the Earth is a little faster than the speed of light in the deep space away from the charged particles. So these are nuclear waves. They are not electromagnetic waves that interact with the electron shells. They interact with the nuclei and with the internal components of the proton and the neutron. What I have the audacity to say to you is that we now have a tool that we do not have to talk about nuclear physics. We can go in there and engineer the nucleus. And transmutation is only one of the things that can be done. And again, the basis of this has been well established in the literature since 1921. With these waves, you see, most of our ideas of the macro world are given to us by the ordinary photon interaction, which is almost always an interaction with the electron shells. This is a different order of reality. We're really dealing now in hyperspaces, at least 11 dimensions, and the world looks quite different indeed. And physical reality, in this kind of physics, looks quite different indeed from the ideas we have in our head, from classical electromagnetics and classical physics and the normal macro world. Just as quantum mechanics was a drastic change to classical mechanics, this is an even further drastic change to quantum mechanics because it makes what had been statistical now deterministic and engineerable. I'm an engineer. I don't want to play statistics. I want to make models, and I want to make the sucker work. The great cosmic engines of the universe do not operate with the residues of the differential operators making the force fields. That's the garbage that's thrown out. The great cosmic engines of the universe operate inside vector zero systems. That includes all the nuclei in the universe and everything inside of them that modern physics has found out about. Okay, this kind of wave can be modeled as a longitudinal wave. I won't go into that whole treatment. I'll just say that whereas you model the normal wave as a transverse wave, you model this one as a longitudinal wave. And indeed, when you interfere this wave, you break up the coherence of the substructure. They now no longer sum to zero, and guess what that gives you? It gives you a non-zero vector, an E field and a B field out there. Real energy now appears as a distance out there from two transmitters or two wave projectors, and yet what's in the middle is not energy flow in the normal sense that we transmit in an ordinary electromagnetic wave. It's really an artificial potential. The closest thing we have to calling it is an electrostatic wave. A more accurate description is it is a direct wave in the curvature of space-time itself. It's a general relativistic wave or a gravitational wave. So if we have two projectors, these might be two modified radar antenna, and we intersect them at a distance, we can produce energy at a distance. And that energy arises in the space-time of that intersection zone. It doesn't matter if that's inside a mountain or inside a missile or inside an airplane, inside a human body. I have given you now the secret of how to build Tesla's Voronoi death ray to mow down people by the thousands, which you can do with that device right there. And you can modify ordinary radars to do that. It has another very nice feature. In modern physics, space-time has a very high charge, very high potential. They call it a pseudo-potential. If I lower the potential of my projectors below zero, in other words, I make negative potential, pretty strong negative, what happens in the intersection zone is not the appearance of energy, but the disappearance of energy. When I bend space-time, if I bend it in one fashion, the local region looks like a source. It looks like it's producing energy. If I bend it the other way, it looks like a sink. It looks like energy is disappearing. This is real. This is general relativity. Now, conservation of energy law that we apply in special relativity has gone out the window, as is well known in physics, in a local general relativistic system. You do not have to conserve energy at all. What really happens is I either put the energy in here and get it out there, or I take it out from there and I get it back here, and I've got to dump it or burn out my projectors. Well, it's you make a dump, and you simply transform it in the other mode and switch it over to the dump. That's the way the Soviets do it. Nature has been doing this all the time, and fault zones and stresses in the rocks and all the interference of the scale potentials that are made there create fields of distance. Glowing lights, this is a picture of earthquake lights from the U.S. Geological Service. There are 1,200 locations in the United States alone where you can see glowing balls of energy, electromagnetic energy, controlled energy at a distance on any decent weather night. If you care to go out there and look and take pictures, it's easy to investigate. The so-called Earth stress lights. And with this modality, by using one additional thing, by using three-dimensional interferometry and using Fourier expansions, multiple frequencies, you can make such controlled balls of electromagnetic energy at a distance, just like that, like the snap of a finger. We have done that in the laboratory. The human system and everything that's a mammal, the rats, the roaches, everything else even, have been doing this all the time. We measure brain waves, we measure the residue, E field and B field, that's going on. What's really going on in the brain is all the little ion fields that make electric fields, that make magnetic fields, that sum to zero. The structure of that is the real activity of the human brain. I think without dwelling on it that you can see the two cerebral hemispheres make a scalar interferometer, and if those patterns are correct, you can project or create energy at a distance like inside a metal object, and you can get metal bending that way. Now, the kind of metal bending I'm talking about is not the amazing rand bending something is dealt with when you're not looking at him. I'm talking about what Jack Hout does when he takes a control sample and another sample, and the little old lady in tennis shoes who just happens to be a four-star general's wife bends that thing, which is thick as your little finger and the highest test steel known to aerospace industry, bends that thing in an angle and it turns blue. He takes both samples, the control sample and that sample, back to the laboratory sections and looks at them under the electron microscope. And the one that is the control sample has the normal brain structure. The one that is the one that's bent by the human being, for real, not fakery, has no brain structure. The brain structure has been destroyed. It looks like the surface of the moon has been subjected to intense point heating throughout the brain structure. I have just given you the physical mechanism and the physics by which the body is able to do that. It is real. It is not a fake. Jack Hout, I believe, does he not work for your company? Ex-scientist. don't dwell on what all else the biological system can do with that. Let us suffice to say that we can derive rigorously in terms of physics, not metaphysics, all of the mechanisms for parapsychology. Well, if you were weaponizing that for a big weapon, if you hit this thing explosively with your projectors and you fire two pulses so the pulses meet, an interesting thing occurs. You fire in the high potential mode, you get an electromagnetic explosion at a distance. If you fire in a low potential mode, you get a cold explosion at a distance. It's a sudden withdrawal of energy in the intersection zone. Both types of weapons widely deployed in the Soviet Union and tested. The recent, some years back, so-called booms off the East Coast, some of those were seen as flashes, estimated to be about 100 tons of TNT equivalent, were actually the orientation and alignment of such howitzers in the Soviet Union. They have had such howitzers since April 1963, specifically the first operational test was April 11th, 1963, 100 miles north of Puerto Rico. The most dramatic expression of the cold explosion in recent times occurred on April 9th, 1984, and the papers fortunately won't let this one go. Off the coast of Japan, about 150 or 200 miles, or really 200 miles from downtown Tokyo, out near the Kuriles, a sudden, gigantic, explosive eruption occurred above the water. A cloud, so to speak, very dense, rose rapidly to 60,000 feet and 150-mile diameter. Five 747s out there, one of which was piloted by a former B-52 pilot who thought he'd just seen the most massive nuclear explosion he ever saw, it had a mushroom shape, prepared evasive action, turned off course, put on oxygen mask, prepared and braced for a shock wave which never came. There was no flash. This was the cold explosion. A laser physicist friend of mine that I'm working with in California, in the laboratory where we're using only milliwatts at best, and we're using distances about that far, has done a little cold explosion over a dish of water, and you get the mushroom cloud exactly like that, right? That thing was called everything under the sun, bubbling gas, you know, plumes, all sorts of things. It was a cold explosion. The ocean there is 21,000 feet deep. It's too deep for submarines. Indicates it was a man-made phenomenon. But it didn't end there. Dr. Daniel Walker and colleagues have access to sophisticated underwater acoustic equipment and seismic equipment, did a complete study on that thing. It's published in the Journal of Science recently. As a matter of fact, after his study, he successfully ruled out any kind of ordinary, known, natural phenomena. So we're left with the conclusion that he and his colleague made. It's either a man-made phenomenon or an as-yet unknown natural phenomenon. We shouldn't have too many natural phenomena unknown that explode for 150 miles, particularly when it's happened several times before in the open literature. That is a rigorous paper published in the Journal Science very recently. Unfortunately, the journal saw fit to turn down my colleague and my explanation of what was going on and a complete date list of incidents and history and types of Soviet weapons to back it up. Here's just one more incident to show you that these types of sudden mushroom rises from the ocean or near the ocean, above the ocean, in gigantic size have occurred repeatedly with other suspicious incidents. That particular earthquake is highly suspect. Can you not see that if I dump energy with very powerful radiators and continue to dump energy on both sides of the fault zone, it doesn't matter where the extra energy comes from. With the piezoelectric effect, I'm transforming that into mechanical stress. And if I do that long enough and build up enough energy, that plate is going to slip and you'll get a natural earthquake, natural-looking earthquake, man-made. That's how you make earthquakes. Well, if you do it in the cold explosion, you're going to have to dump a lot of that energy when it's 150 miles across. That is one way over a lot of energy. that you suddenly extracted, and here it comes, it's headed for you. It'll simply melt your projectors unless you dump it somewhere. So you switch the projector into the transmit mode, and you catch it and hold it in the storage bank temporarily, and then you fire it off somewhere where it won't do any harm, like Bennett Island. Here is an exhaust that is 150 miles long, seen by our other satellites, from a site that repeatedly exhibits these, almost 100 now that we've seen. This particular exhaust is about a little over 1 degree above the horizontal. Now, volcanoes don't do that. They don't look like that. Let's see the next slide. From the same island, we see double puffs indicating the interferometer transmitters. We see multiple puffs within them sometimes. And in fact, the satellites have even from time to time caught the actual burst, showing that it's an explosive beginning of the exhaust. These are weather satellites, U.S. weather satellites. They are not classified. Unfortunately, they are from way out there. We need some low-level satellite photography, which I simply do not have. It would be interesting to look at it if I had it. Here's one where the explosive burst was caught just erupting from the island. These things here blaze away sometimes for hours and hours and days at a time with those kinds of massive exhausts of heat and energy. I'll show you where they're pulling out the energy and what they're doing with it. That's about the plumes, just to show you that way back there from those exhaust plumes off that island, we had some airplanes flew through it. They're mostly ice particles from the expansion and so forth, as you would expect when you dump a phenomenon. Actually, you entrain a lot of the cold air, you get circulation, you get all kinds of effects there. So you do get a lot of ice form, a little mud, and this kind of thing.